Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Thanks everyone for being here. Today is our fourth installment of our seminar series that Dr. Bradhout and I are running here from the International Migration Institute on the topic of migration, politics, social change. Today it's our great honor to welcome Professor Rainer Baybach. Rainer Baybach was recently, very formally, the Dean of Graduate Studies at the European University Institute. He's department chair and an expert on political theory, and quite frankly, one of the foremost experts on transnational citizenship. So please, put your hands together, give a nice warm welcome to Mr. Rainer Baybach.
Thank you, Ali. Thanks a lot for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here. It was also a great pleasure to find out that Ali's work and mine is nicely complementary, since he sent me a paper that was also on transnational political participation looking at the behavioral side, to which extent migrants would participate in political elections in their home countries and in their sending countries, and whether the two kinds of engagements can be combined. What I will be talking about is the institutional side of that same question. To which extent can migrants be enfranchised in home country contexts and in receiving or destination country contexts? That seems a very specific question, but I think it has some fairly interesting implications how we think about democracy in general. And citizenship. And this is what I will try to tease out. And we also have some nice data to show you that what we think is happening is actually out there in the real world. I should mention that this is a co-authored paper together with my former supervisor Jean-Thomas Arrighi. We've just submitted the paper to a journal, so this is why, if for those of you who have it, I ask you not to circulate it too widely, because that might interfere with the review process, but I'll try to sum it up for you. So let's start with imagining something that the American political philosopher John Rawls called a closed society. Closed society for John Rawls is a society that people enter through birth and leave through death. So there is no migration. In such a society, the question who has the right to vote in elections is not a very interesting one, because you assume by definition that all citizens are residents. And secondly, if the societies are democracies, you would assume normatively that all residents have to be citizens, that they have the right to citizenship, and therefore it's the resident citizens who are those who have to be enfranchised in elections. Of course, there will be some people excluded, basically those of minor age, but adult resident citizens are the standard demos that is enfranchised to vote in any type of elections, be they national ones or local elections, in a closed society model of democracy, where no migration happens. Now, let's bring in the migrants. First, you have the immigrants, the people who come from a place and settle in another one. And the immigrants carry a citizenship of origin with them. So the population changes and is now composed of the resident citizens and the non-citizen residents who have another nationality. Secondly, and that's basically just the other side of the coin, depending on which country you look at, migration also takes out people who used to be resident citizens and then become non-resident citizens who live still with their citizenship in another country. So the state population, the population that states refer to, consists now of these three components: the resident citizens, the non-citizen residents, and the non-resident citizens. That fact in itself is already something that is slightly puzzling, because it depends on what citizenship is and how it works. It depends on what I've called the stickiness of citizenship status. Citizenship status is not changed by migration, not automatically changed by migration at least. It's carried across borders. Citizenship status is generally acquired at birth, and it sticks with you for your whole life unless you renounce it or it's withdrawn from you by the state of origin. But the standard assumption is you cross the border, you still have the same citizenship, and that creates the discrepancy between residence and citizenship that we see here. Now, for democracy, that means now they have to decide how to respond to this phenomenon. What's the population that should be included in the demos, that should have the franchise and should be able to vote for the laws or those who make the laws? So response number one is ignore the migrants. Just stick to the old formula. It's only the resident citizens who are included in the demos. This is what you might call insulating the demos from the impact of migration. The second possible response is to say, no, you know, the franchise in national elections is attached to citizenship. So therefore, the response to migration is that all those who are citizens should be included in the demos, but those who are not citizens have to be excluded. So you get this solution here, which includes the expats, the non-resident citizens, but excludes the non-citizen residents. And in a way, this is a form of deterritorializing the demos. You know, the demos is no longer bound to residents, doesn't depend on being in the territory, it just depends on citizenship status. The second response, or an alternative response to this, might be the opposite one. And this is actually something that many political theorists have advocated on normative grounds. The argument is basically that democracies operate within territorial jurisdictions. The laws that they adopt apply to all who are residents in the territory. They are subjected to these laws. Therefore, all who are subjected to these laws should be included in or represented in the making of these laws. So therefore, the demos should include all the residents, including the non-citizen residents, but should exclude, for the same reason, those who have left the country, even if they carry the citizenship of that country. So this is what you might call a post-national conception of the demos. Nationality goes out of the equation and residence becomes the dominant criteria for allocating voting rights. Then a fourth type of response might be saying, well, why does it have to be either or? Can we not recognize that both immigration and emigration generates a form of link to the state that gives people an entitlement to be represented in the making of the laws? So this is what you might call a genuine link. I take that term from international legal terminology. There was a famous International Court of Justice judgment in 1955 that had to deal with the question of conflict of citizenship of allocation, and the court came up with this formula that nationality should rely on a genuine link between a person and a state. So if you count a genuine link, you might say, well, the immigrants acquire a genuine link through taking up long-term residence, but the immigrants retain a genuine link because they've been born and raised in that country, and they might want to return, and they might communicate with their family back home. So both of these links can be counted, and therefore an expansive conception of the demos would include both the non-citizens and the non-residents. Finally, you might say, well, this is all nice normative talk, but actually what happens, or what on some conceptions should happen, is that democracies should determine for themselves who their members are. I call this a Schumpeterian conception of the demos, because in a side remark in his famous book on capitalism, socialism, and democracy, Joseph Schumpeter said, well, don't we have to leave it to every populus to determine its own members? So the idea is this is about self-determination. Democracies can decide whom they include, and they will decide it differently. And there is no normative meta-theory that tells them what to do. It's a matter of democratic legitimacy that the existing demos can decide on whom to include in the future demos. And if you buy into that kind of theory, you might think that, well, you will find any of the patterns that we've mentioned before. Some democracies might opt for a very expansive conception of the demos, one for a very insular one, or any of the others, the deterritorialized or the post-national one. Now, the point of our paper is to say that none of this applies to the real world. The pattern that we find in the real world is a different one. And that pattern emerges only if we introduce another distinction, which is the distinction between levels of democracy. So far, we've only looked at societies as one entity, basically the state. And we thought about elections as national elections. But all democratic societies or states that are sufficiently large have elections at various levels. In many countries, these are three levels: the national level, the provincial or regional level, and a local level. But in virtually all democracies, you at least have these two levels, a local level and a national level. Does it make sense to talk about the local level as having a demos? Yes, if you go for the minimalistic definition of the demos that I have implied here, which is the demos consists of anybody who is eligible to vote, then locally demo exists, because in any local election you need an electoral register in which the names of the people are listed who have the right to vote in that local election. So there is a local demos in that sense. And the question arises, who is included in the local demos? And the answer that we find is, it's quite significantly different from the response to who is included in the national demos in many of the democracies that we've studied. So, here is the answer that we find empirically as the dominant one, the modular one, among a large set of democracies that we include in our study. In national elections, we find the dominant response is a deterritorialized demos. So citizenship is increasingly sufficient in order to be eligible to vote in national elections, independently of whether you reside in the country or whether you reside abroad. In local elections, we find the post-national response. Residence is increasingly sufficient as a criteria to vote in local elections, no matter whether you are a citizen of the country or you're not a citizen of the country. And that is something that is not predicted by any of the democratic theories that I have initially alluded to. And this is why the final part of the paper picks up the political theory debate or the democratic theory debate and tries to make sense of the actual pattern and tries to define a normative standard that would support it, but also by which then state practices of extending the franchise could be critically evaluated. But before I get to this, I will just explain the empirical part of what we've done in order to show that that pattern actually is now the dominant one among Western democracies. So what the research topic or question was is how the demos is expanded in migration contexts, how democracies have actually adapted their franchise to the challenge of migration. I have to emphasize that paper doesn't try to explain why they do it. It just tries to establish that they do it. So it's largely a descriptive question in terms of the statistical material that we produce. We try to show that there are patterns of expansion. And we also try to show that the patterns are not, you know, happening in all countries. So therefore we look at the exceptions where they don't happen. And we pay special attention to these exceptions because we try to find out, are there some general mechanisms that are countervailing, or are these really contextual factors that don't make up for a counter pattern? And this is what we tend to find. And there is the normative question in the end. As I already said, what about the legitimacy of these expanded forms of the franchise? Can this be supported from within a certain version of democratic theory? It's for others who are better also in statistical methodologies than we are to then use our data to test causal hypotheses. For example, to throw in some independent variables that try to explain why some countries expanded this way and others didn't. Or the other way around, you might take our data and say, what's the impact of this? You know, in terms, for example, of voting behavior, which would be Ali's question. So it would be nice to actually merge our two data sets and see what the associations are between the institutional and behavioral dimensions of transnational voting. But anyway, this is not what we do in this short paper. The data that we have are data that we've collected through an observatory on citizenship and voting rights that we've built up in Florence. It's called the UDO Citizenship Observatory. UDO has this idea, you do it, but it actually means European Union Democracy Observatory. And as the name says, initially this was confined to the European member states. We expanded it to the rest of the Council of Europe, so 46 countries in Europe, but now we've also expanded towards the Americas. And so we included 19 countries of the Americas in this study, and that allowed us for the first time to also have these transatlantic comparisons, how democracies react to migration. And for me, that was really partly surprising because in Europe, as in America, everybody thinks we are exceptional, right? In Europe, everybody thinks there's this special context of EU and European integration, and that obviously changes how we think about migration and democracy. We were really surprised to find lots of similar or comparable stories, especially in South America. You might again say, which is very likely, South America is the most plausible other region in the world where you will find this, because there are regional integration efforts and there is a strong history of out-migration and initial nation building as countries of immigration. So it's not such a big surprise, but that's already a large number of all the democracies in the world. You know, if you count together the whole of Europe and the whole of North and South America, it becomes significant even for a global study that we haven't yet done. So what we've studied is we've collected legislative material on who has the right to vote. And we've divided it up basically into three categories of persons: the citizen residents, the non-resident citizens, and the non-citizen residents, right? And their respective rights to participate in elections. We have the data on their right to participate in all types of elections, across levels, and also in various types of elections in the sense of parliamentary types of elections, presidential or mayoral types of elections, or plebiscitary types of elections. So that's all there in our data set. And we've done this for 47 states in the EU and Americas counted together. Now, in order to do any kind of analysis for a data set with N 47, you need to become quantitative. You cannot leave it at the qualitative descriptive level alone, because you don't see the patterns. So we had to produce indicators. We actually, in our UDO Citizenship Observatory, we have already developed a very comprehensive set of indicators on voting rights for all types of elections, for all these categories, for various methods of voting, etc., that we call ELEC Law, and you can find this on the website, you can download, you can play with the indicators. We did not use these indicators because we haven't yet coded them for the Americas. So what we did instead is we looked again at our question and said, basically what we are interested in is not degrees of inclusiveness or methods of voting or types of representation mechanisms. We are interested in one simple question, which is a binary one. Are you included or you are excluded from the demos? And the criteria is basically, are you eligible to vote or are you ineligible to vote? You can be eligible to vote, and it can still be very difficult for you to vote because you have to register to vote, because you have to travel to an embassy to cast your vote. Your vote might not be counted in the same way as if you're an immigrant, as the vote of somebody who is a citizen resident. All that makes a big difference, right? But that is what we ignore here. Here we just say the demos, the boundaries of the demos change, the external boundaries of the demos change as soon as a non-citizen resident or a non-resident citizen is considered as being eligible to vote in elections. We also don't consider here candidacy rights. So it's not about the right to be voted, but the right to vote. Right? So this is what we did in order to simplify and make it possible to codify also the Americas just by looking at the material that we had collected. And what we find can be summed up in these two propositions. We don't dare to call them hypotheses because we don't do any explanatory analysis. So let's call them propositions or inductive generalizations. One is we find a pattern of separation. That means the national franchise can be separated from residents. It no longer depends on residents as it used to in the past. And the local franchise can be separated from citizenship. These two propositions defeat or oppose the insular demos conception, and that says there cannot be such a separation. You have to be both a resident and a citizen. You say this is no longer the case, this is no longer the standard pattern. We find these separations, but they are specific at the national level and at the local level. Separation from citizenship, from residence at the national level, separation from citizenship at the local level. Conversely, there are also patterns of non-separation, things that cannot be kept separate. Right? And this is that the national franchise still depends on citizenship and is not post-national in nearly all of the cases that we found. And the local franchise cannot be separated from residents. Actually, we haven't found a single case in which you could vote in local elections as an expat. Right? Which is interesting. It's not logically excluded, but it just doesn't come up in our data set. Right? You can overwhelmingly vote in national elections, but not in local elections. So there's something interesting going on there. The level specificity of the franchise, I think, is the main story that has been ignored in most of the literature so far. So here is a very crude summary of what we find. This is how the separation patterns are confirmed. We find 81% of the cases in our set in which the national franchise no longer depends on being a resident. And we also find 81%, this is just a coincidence, in which the local franchise no longer depends on being a national citizen of the country. If you have any question about these tables, raise your hands. We also find the non-separation patterns confirmed even more strongly. In 85% of the cases, the national franchise still depends on being a citizen of the country. And as I said before, in 100% of the cases, you have to be a resident in order to vote in local elections. I said before, the Schumpeterian hypothesis, you know, suggests that there might be some random variation. If every demos can decide for himself or itself whom to include, then you would also expect to find something like a polity in which the non-residents can vote in local elections but not in national ones, and the non-citizens can vote in national elections but not the local ones. But that is something that you would be really surprised to find. You know, if the difference between national and local level didn't make any difference, conceptually, yeah, then you might also expect to find these patterns. But that is actually something that would be really surprising, and there is no single case. And we don't think there will be any case worldwide if we expand that study where we find that pattern. So that's in a way the evidence that we have. So here are some descriptive, more detailed findings. What we did also, we made some further distinction when we coded our indicators, which is restricted forms of expansion and unrestricted form of expansion. What do we mean by this? Just to give you an example, In the UK, there is a voting right in national elections for non-citizens who are Irish or Commonwealth citizens. They can actually not just vote in Westminster elections, they can also be elected in Westminster elections. You don't have to carry a British passport to be a Member of Parliament in Westminster. However, we call this a restricted expansion because it still depends on citizenship. You just don't have to be the citizen of Britain, of the UK, but you need a specific other citizenship, meaning Irish or Commonwealth. So in that sense, it's a halfway expansion. It disconnects the franchise from national citizenship, but it doesn't disconnect it from citizenship altogether because only specific other citizens can acquire that franchise. The same thing applies to restricted and unrestricted forms of expansion of the local franchise, where you are also the expat franchise, where whenever you find a citizenship condition or a residence condition that is, restricts the expansion, we've counted it as restrictive. If it just depends on being a citizen, if you are, for example, if you are abroad, if you can vote from abroad, if you have a passport and that's all you need, then that's an unrestricted expansion of the expat voting. If you can vote from abroad only for the first 2, 5, or 15 years, 15 is the case in the UK, then there is a residence qualification for the expat voting right. So it's not completely unrestricted because it doesn't depend just on citizenship, it also depends on residence. You see the logic of this? So this is how we code it, then restricted and unrestricted. Now, quickly to show you what the geographic patterns are on the two continents. For the non-citizen franchise, so the immigrant side of this, we find interesting enough that it's North America where it still doesn't exist. None of the North American countries, including Central America, allows those who are not citizens to vote in either national or local elections. Naturalization is the basic condition for access to any voting rights in these countries. On the European side, there is no color red, and the reason for this is very simple, it's the EU. Since we only cover EU states, and the EU treaties include local voting rights for EU citizens in other member states, there is by default a restricted form of expansion of the local franchise throughout the EU. You might say, well, this biases the whole thing, you bring in a different level, this is EU law, but if you think about this, this is law that the member states have adopted. They've agreed to expand their own conceptions of the local demos by accepting that the citizens of other EU member states will become part of the local demos. This is agreed by the member states who agreed to the treaty change in Maastricht in 1992. So that is relevant for the conception of the demos. It's not just an alien thing floating out there. It's part of what changes European democracies throughout. So this is why there is no color red. You still have quite some differences in Europe, and that has to do with the fact that some countries, these are the dark green ones here, went further than this and said, in local elections, we then franchise also third country nationals. There's no EU law that obliges us to do this, but we think it makes sense to think of them as members of the local demos just because they're residents. And then you have these countries like Ireland, Britain, and Portugal, where there is a reciprocity-based franchise. In the case of all of these countries, even at the national level, there is reciprocity with specific other nationalities that can be included, but it doesn't concern everybody. The most interesting case is South America, and there is where you find the biggest variation. So Suriname is the one red spot, no franchise for non-citizens there. But you find then also these dark blue countries, which are Ecuador, Chile, and Uruguay, that do extend the national franchise to non-citizens generally. Not just based on reciprocity, but anybody who is a certain time of residence can then vote independently of which passport they have. Ecuador joined this group only recently, and it's now the most inclusive case in that sense, the most expansive franchise on both the emigrate side and the immigrant side, as we will see on the next slide. So this is the non-resident franchise. The color blue is missing here because there is that applies just to national elections, so we only have three types of countries where it doesn't exist, where it's restricted, and where it's unrestricted, meaning it just depends on having the right kind of passport. And as you see, this is the majority of countries now. Unrestricted franchise in national elections for expats has become the norm, the standard case. And that is not just true for these countries, as we know from a study by IDEA, the International Institute for Democratic Electoral Assistance. This is a global trend. It's a global trend that happened basically in the last 30 years or so. After World War II, there were very, very few countries that allowed their expats to vote, and now it's the big majority of all democracies that do so. And I will come back to the question whether there's some legitimacy to this. There are a few countries that still hold out and don't allow this. In Europe, these are basically Ireland, Greece, Cyprus, and Malta. And I asked this question before when we had this little conversation with the students up there. What do they have in common? What do you guess why these countries don't allow their non-resident citizens to vote?
There are too many of
us. Exactly. It's countries with very, very large diasporas. So there's obviously a fear about a swamping effect, as I call it, right, of the diaspora vote if it's fully included. In Ireland, there is now a vigorous debate about this. There was also a potential fear previously that the Irish diaspora, you know, might have a political bias in certain ways, might have been involved in sponsoring the conflict while it was still going on. So these were things holding back the extension of the franchise in these particular cases. In Latin America, we find a couple of cases of resistance in Central America, and then Chile and Uruguay. But Chile is going to change very soon, and is also going to extend the vote to its expats. So here is my favorite series of slides. That looks rather confusing, but imagine this is again the situation of the the closed society. So there is only initially assumed that all these countries are red, meaning there is no franchise for either the expats or the immigrants. And now let's bring in those countries, let's cut out those countries where there is actually a franchise for the non-citizens at either the local or the national level, and let's distinguish between those where the franchise is restricted or unrestricted. You see the divide up roughly evenly between these two categories. And now let's look at the overlap. What if we combine this with the franchise for non-resident? Non-residents, so the expats, and again distinguish between unrestricted and restricted, and finally let's see how this overlaps. So let's take seriously that all these countries both relate to emigrants and to immigrants and have to regulate whom to exclude or exclude on both sides of the demos. And what you find there is the modal value, don't know if this is a pointer, over here, laser. Okay, laser doesn't work. Anyway, you see, this is the largest category. So this whole area means there is the predicted form of expansion happening. So you find expansion at the national level towards the non-residents and expansion at the local level towards the non-citizens. These are the areas where there's some form of restriction, and this is the combination where there's no restriction on either side. Okay. So, this is just a verbal explanation of these findings. What we've seen in our sample is very few insular cases, only three in the sample of 47, and two of them Central American and one Suriname. Suriname is also the country that has most recently transited to democracy or become independent. So what you see, I think what we see there is little exposure, not a long term time of democratic stability and little exposure to migration. Whereas most of the other countries in the set are in a way old democracies that have had exposure to migration on the immigration or emigration side for a long time. That means they had more time to adapt. And they did adapt in the predicted way in most of the cases. We find also in Latin America the most unrestricted forms of expansion. And on both sides, these are Ecuador and Uruguay, and soon Chile will be in the same group. What we generally see as predicted, post-national expansion happens at the local level, which is in a way paradoxical. You know, if you call it post-national, you would think this is about the national level, but it isn't. It's about the local level. So it's actually, the very term post-national is somewhat problematic, and I tend to avoid it for that reason too. It suggests the transformation is happening in the world of the states. No, it's happening above and below the world of states. And deterritorialization does happen at the national level. Citizenship becomes more important than residence. And finally, this was the overlapping area in the last slide, the level of specific expansion of the demos for non-residents and non-citizens happens in two-thirds of the cases overall and in one-third of the cases without any restrictions. So, as I said before, I will also talk briefly about the cases where it doesn't happen. So it's not 100%. You know, there are these outliers where we find one or the other forms of resistance against these patterns of separation. And we discuss in the section of the paper what might be the possible reasons for this resistance in order to find out whether these are generalizable patterns or whether they are contextual. And we tend to think they're mostly contextual, but they can also be, they can exist in similar ways across various countries. So the legal obstacle for including non-citizens in many European countries came from interpretations of the constitution. So there are constitutions that tend to define who belongs to the demos. In at least the interpretation of the constitution tends to be that this just means it's about citizens. The non-citizens cannot be included. The famous judgment was by the German Constitutional Court in 1990 when it said the German people, you know, is a unitary concept. And who belongs to the people are the German citizens and nobody else. And if the legislator thinks there is a democratic problem because the non-citizens are also subjected to the laws, then it's open to the legislator to change the citizenship law and to facilitate naturalization, which actually happened in Germany in the late 1990s. But the legislator cannot set aside citizenship and include the non-citizens even at the local level because the demos must be defined in the same way at all levels of the German constitution. In other cases, we find that the resistance has more to do with a traditional fear how foreigners might interfere with domestic politics. So the foreigner as a potential political threat because he or she has a loyalty towards another sovereign or imports a conflict from the homeland into the hostland. And therefore, the foreigners cannot be enfranchised even in local elections because that would somehow conflict with undivisible sovereignty and commitments of loyalty that all citizens have to profess. This is what we found more often in the Central American cases. Now, for the non-residents, those countries that didn't extend the national vote to the non-residents, I've already explained what the resistance is. It has less to do with constitutional obstacles. Very few constitutions actually say you have to be a resident in order to vote. It has more to do with political resistance, the fear of an overwhelming diaspora, for example, and sometimes even the reform itself that introduced the expert vote was driven by constitutional courts. For example, in the case of Austria, it was the constitutional court that just struck down the electoral law and said, the constitution says all citizens enjoy voting rights. So how come you exclude the experts? You have to include them. Political obstacles do exist too. For non-citizens, there is a hypothesis suggested by Christian Jobke in his work that it's always the left that wants to include the immigrants and always the right that wants to include the emigrants. Right? We find by and large this is true for Europe, but it's definitely false for South America. It's actually sometimes the other way around in South America, which is in a way surprising. But if you think that countries that transit to democracy very often produce political exiles, people who had to leave during an authoritarian regime. And then when the country introduces democracy and thinks again about who should have the right to vote, it's quite natural that they would think those who were driven into exile have a claim to participate in the vote, and that often comes from the left-wing forces that promoted democratic transition and is resisted by some of the right-wing forces. On the other hand, in some of the Latin American dictatorships, in Chile, in Uruguay during the interwar period, we found it was the dictators themselves that introduced non-citizen voting rights because they were interested in catching the vote of wealthy white Europeans that were very conservative or extreme right-wing in their political orientations. So Pinochet had this idea, and the extension of the voting rights to non-citizens in Chile happened under the Pinochet regime, which is, you know, a surprising lesson for the European left, who thinks this is always a very progressive thing to do. So there are these unexpected political dynamics in specific contexts. And a similar story can be told about the extension to non-residents. So what about the non-separation hypothesis? You know, the cases where we find extensions that we don't expect, for example, non-citizens being included in the national franchise, or non-residents being included in the local franchise. So on the second point, I said before, we didn't find any case that we called it as a right to vote in local elections from abroad. But we know there have been cases in the past, and if we had called it differently, we might have also included one of the present cases. There are certain forms, like in the state of Michoacán in Mexico, where a certain type of Mexican migrants who have maintained some specific ties to Michoacán are allowed to vote there in local elections. That's not Mexico-wide. This is why it doesn't show up in our coding, which is all this countrywide. But that exists. In Spain, it existed until 2011 on a national scale. There was no difference between national and local voting rights, and you could vote from abroad in local elections. And the story why this was eventually changed was that a regional party in Galicia, in northwestern Spain, found out that it systematically lost out in local elections. And the Partido Popular, the conservative party, always won because it mobilized the external vote among people who had not had never lived in the municipality. You know, their parents could have come from there. But it mobilized effectively the vote, and at local level, it really makes a difference. You know, if you manage to have a good turnout somewhere in another country, that can make a difference for the local mayor, for example. The Partido, the Bloque Gallego, managed to convince the Spanish parliament that this was unfair because these people were no longer so sufficiently involved in local politics and therefore shouldn't have the right to vote. And this is why Spain abandoned this kind of practice. They called it, the resolution of the Spanish parliament called it a democratic anomaly. And this is what we think it actually is. Similar story about the non-citizen franchise in national elections that I've already explained previously, so I will skip this. I will also skip this slide. It's actually not included in the paper. We had to cut it down, you know, because of the size limitations. One more minute. This is another reason to skip this part. Let me just say in the end, there is the section in the paper where I then speak with the voice of the democratic theorist who tries to make sense of this in normative terms of democratic legitimacy. And I've defended for a while a principle of citizenship inclusion that I call the stakeholder principle that says democracies should trace the genuine links that individuals have to a particular polity. And that should be the relevant criteria for including them. So not democratic self-determination. It should depend on what an individual's relation to a particular polity is when determining how strong the claim is to have citizenship status or voting rights. But the second important point is that democratic stakeholdership means you are included as a member in a self-governing polity. Democracy is ultimately normatively about collective self-government of citizens altogether. That means the criteria for inclusion also have to reflect the conditions for self-government of the polity. And the point is, the conditions for self-government are not the same across levels. The conditions for the self-government of an independent state in the international environment of the society of states are fundamentally different from the conditions of self-government of a local municipality that is embedded in the territory of a democracy. And reflecting on the difference between these conditions may provide justification for the fact that citizenship is acquired by birth and carried across borders unless you voluntarily renounce it, and that includes also the right to vote in national elections, whereas citizenship at the local level ought to be based on a different interpretation of what it means to be a stakeholder, and that is to be a resident. In the municipality, you have a stake in local politics if you are a resident, because municipalities with open borders provide services to the residents in their communities, and for them it would actually be discriminatory to distinguish between those born in the municipality and those born outside. So thinking about these conditions of democratic self-government may provide justification for the actual pattern that we find, which is an expansion to include the non-residents in national elections and expansion to include the non-citizens who are residents in the local level. This is this is going backwards. Conclusions are, I won't sum them up, I've said this before. Let me just finish with what I think is a research agenda for carrying this forward. We obviously want to include other regions of the world, not just Americas and Europe. We could go beyond the binary coding of indicators that just measure eligibility, because there can be degrees of inclusiveness that would be interesting to capture, and we've already developed the instruments to do this for Europe, but not yet for the Americas. This is the next thing that we will do. Longitudinal data on how the franchise has changed over time would help us to study dissemination mechanisms. You know, which country goes first, which country comes next. And to identify mechanisms and drivers of policy change. So if you want to become more explanatory, it would be very important to actually have longitudinal data about the change. So far, this is just cross-sectional. We need comparative case studies on individual cases to understand better the mechanisms. But most important and take-home message of this whole talk is we need to revise our standard theories of citizenship and democracy by paying equal attention to immigration and emigration. If you look at the individual, for micro-level study, it's obvious. You know, every immigrant is an immigrant and the other way around. Right? They always relate to two states. And we tend to focus on one of the two sides by doing either diaspora studies or immigrant integration studies. But bringing the two perspectives together makes you understand much more about the process at the micro-level. But the story here is also about the macro level. All democracies have laws that regulate incoming citizenship and outgoing citizenship, voting rights for those who come in, voting rights for those who leave in different ways. And by realizing that states always also have these two sides, we understand much better how democracy is responding to international migration. Thank you.